The Filtoramic antenna is featured in this X4 model, along with dual speakers that fill the room with the best AM sound ever heard.
All the DJs say, this one's on its way. It's the cream of the crop. It's the thing of the pops. Here's tomorrow's top to today.
You ain't heard nothing yet.
What's up, posers? Welcome to Singles Action. I'm your co-host, Justin Hensley.
I am your other co-host, Dylan Hensley.
And this is the show, but it's really just a monthly special that we do, where we take an issue of Billboard magazine from the past and go through it page by page, loosely, and talk about the charts, articles, and ads. This is our second attempt at this, and I think we've streamlined it a little bit. Hopefully it flows a little more, but at the same time, this issue we chose has a lot more pages and ads and charts in them. So,
yeah, I think we both realized in the middle of recording our first Singles Action episode, like, oh, this is a mess. Going page by page, there's not always something interesting. It's a very industry magazine, which we'll talk about a little bit. There are some industry articles that are worth talking about, but the meat of it, we really do want to focus on the charts, because I mean, hence the name.
It's what people care about too with Billboard. Their writing isn't considered one of their strong suits. In the 90s you tended to go to like Rolling Stone or like Spin or any number of other magazine for like articles and interviews. Billboard, most people were mainly only interested in the charts. So yeah, so we say page by page. We're going to go through it in the order that it appears in the magazine, kind of. We'll talk about that in a minute. But we're not going to talk about every single page, because some pages are just boring and there's nothing of note on it. And some of the ads are just very plain, and so it'll be a little more selective. But if you want to follow along with us, if you're listening to the show at home and you can like actually are on your break or at work or something, and you want to flip through the issue with us, check out the link in the description of this episode, and we get all our scans from the worldradiohistory.com Billboard archive. So I have links to them in the notes.
Yeah, this website is a treasure trove. I mean, it's to have access to all of these old Billboard magazines, really awesome. So check out their site, because if you can look all of these charts up on billboard.com, but they're mostly behind a paywall other than maybe the Hot 100s. And you can kind of see some of the, like, if you look up a specific artist or a specific song, you can find all of the charting information in relation to them, but you're not going to get the charts as they appeared in that week for, you know, rock or R&B. It's pretty much the Hot 100. Otherwise, it's all behind a paywall.
Yeah. So these scans are very useful for what we're doing here. Well, we would only do this if these scans existed, really. So, all right, I guess we can get started. This week's issue is for the June 26th, 1999 issue.
A little bit of Monica in my life, a little bit of Erica by my side.
On this website, there are a couple pages missing from the full scan, and there is a tab to the left that is for the missing pages that they kind of just lumped into one PDF file. I'll have a link to it, but to get the specific page you want to look at, you'll have to do control find on the page and type in June 26th. But we'll talk about what that is in a moment. I figured we would start with the cover. The cover of Billboard magazine at this point, because I think in the future it would just become like a regular photo cover. It looks kind of like a newspaper. You know, it's like a bunch of different articles on the front, some ads, and some, here's what's inside.
As a weekly magazine, it really did function more like a Sunday paper.
Yeah, it's definitely a newspaper layout with the blocks of text and like continued on page so-and-so, and yeah. So we're right before Y2K. We're 6 months before Y2K. And
everyone was compliant.
And this majority of the articles in this issue are very focused on technology. So internet music was a newish thing. Napster was already well established at this point, I believe. Had it even been taken down by this point? Or, you know, switched over to a more legitimate version?
Metallica versus Napster Incorporated did not happen until April of 2000. So okay. Napster was still operating as an illegal P2P.
Yeah. And which is, majority of these articles are specifically referencing. The biggest one, we'll just go from left to right on this page because it's kind of funny. So there's a headline here that says MP3 supporters look to future. And it's a fun little article talking about how MP3 is just basically the next step in music and discussing the benefits of the format and all the great things that the MP3 can do, which, you know, RIP MP3, supposedly, since they've decided our MP3 is dead now, even though everyone can still use it for everything. But it's just funny. It's funny seeing how right they were. The Billboard magazine's reporting, I guess, kind of could see it coming, because when we did the 64 issue, it talked about how the coming decade was going to be the biggest year for the record industry, and it basically became that. So,
yeah, I mean, they certainly were paying attention. It's been said that the recording industry, like record labels themselves, not necessarily everyone else working in the music industry, were too late to adopt the MP3 and far too late to embrace the internet as a means of distribution. I mean, like we said, Metallica versus Napster happened in 2000. You know, that if they had been more on top of things, they could have completely circumvented the whole era of piracy. But the internet in 1999 was still such a mysterious thing.
And a perfect example is the next headline is industry mounts defense as bootleg dance CDs flourish. And it's an article complaining about the availability of writable CDs causing issues with the dance community. Basically, like, oh, because people can burn copies and just sell it willy-nilly, that, it's killing the dance music industry. So I'm assuming it's like DJs are making their own mixes and just selling them themselves, or just like straight up copying mixes and selling them. It's funny. They're complaining about burnt CDs at this point.
Yeah. They reference in this article have replaced the once popular illegal beat mixed cassette tapes. So it's not new. I mean, you just have to embrace the fact that people want to access music cheaply.
Right.
I mean, that's the solution.
Well, that's why I think iTunes took off is because they were charging so little for songs, like 99 cents a song.
Yeah.
Pretty good deal. I mean, there's a fair argument to say that artists deserve more for their
work. Absolutely. But, you know, $1 a song. I mean, and that was such a big, that was such a scary thing for the recording industry. The unbundling of the single from the album, which we're a little early for that in 1999. But
yeah,
if you look at the charts, when we get into them, you can definitely see how entrenched music is in the single. So
yeah,
there's a reason.
The last article I want to talk about on the cover is the Circuit City pulls plug on DivX. The subtitle is Home Entertainment War Won by Open DVD. I don't know if you're familiar with DivX. It was a format specifically for movies that was created by Circuit City. So they were trying to combat the DVD with their own program. And I think the primary difference is like the coding was different, and like how it was, instead of like pits and lands on a CD, is some other method. And it just didn't work. It didn't take off. Probably because it was only available in Circuit City. A company that does not exist, which I'm wondering how much of a shadow DivX was on the rest of Circuit City's history. I mean, I don't imagine putting a lot of money into specific technologies was very cheap, but I thought that was a little interesting.
When did Circuit City go bankrupt? 2005?
I'm trying to remember what year ours closed. 2007? 2008 was when it closed? So who knows how...
2008, they filed for bankruptcy. Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, they weren't around much longer before they closed then.
I mean, they were certainly closing stores before that.
Yeah.
I love seeing an old Circuit City, though.
I do, too. Just I love...
All the letters gone, and it's just the block.
The red block. Because they still... The buildings still exist, and, you know, unless they were, like, completely retrofitted with whatever new architecture that the new building going in has, they still have, like, the shell of the Circuit City there. So it's always funny to see those.
Yeah, so many of them were in older shopping centers that, unless they've been completely torn down, are only really used by really low-end stores. So they don't, you know, they're not going to invest in recladding the exterior. You know, it's just going to leave the big red block. And yeah, it's like a place where you can get bundles of socks for really cheap, you know.
I love
an Ollie's or something like that.
Yeah, and we have a Harbor Freight in where our old Circuit City is.
Right. The discount hardware store.
I do love an old Circuit City ad, though, where it was the CG animation of the giant plug coming down into the building.
That beat. I love that beat. The beat and that bass line. They're so killer.
What was the phrase in the commercial?
I know they say Circuit City on the beat. I don't remember what the catch line was.
Let me see if I can find it, because it's too good. If you know what I should do is just put in a little clip here of what it sounds like. Something Circuit City, where service is state of the art. That's right. But I'll find it and drop it in here.
And you got to go look it up too, because the video commercial, the animation is excellent with the big block. It's like a plug, and it swings around and plugs in, and then the name appears. Welcome to Circuit City,
where service is state of the art. There's one more article I wanted to talk about before we get into our first chart, and it's on page 3, and it is the court rules against RIAA in MP3 case. So this was actually kind of a big deal. The RIAA tried to sue the Rio music player makers for being an illegal device. It's basically a digital recorder. So the case wound up failing because there was a law prohibiting the creation of any device whose sole purpose is duplicating CDs. But because it already had other functions, the device itself was no longer illegal. So basically, you could create a CD tape duplicating machine, but as long as it also did one other thing, it was not illegal. I don't know if you could have done something as simple as like put a flashlight or a clock on it, and if you would have got around it, but because you could like also record your own material onto it, it was made legal. And it kind of just gave like MP3 like this free reign. Because like computers had MP3 burning capabilities, so that was, you know, multiple uses in that one device, and that's why you never saw like a thing that only did MP3, like, you know, made copies of MP3.
Yeah, that's such a. It seems like it'd be so hard to, like, why would you make a device that only did that one thing? Like, you could so easily use that same technology for so many other purposes, and. Like, it would only make sense to make a multi-use device. You know, you just make it a digital recorder and an MP3 burner. Like, that makes sense. People would want that.
So, on page 4 is our table of contents, and normally I wouldn't point this out, but it does give you, like, the exact location and the issue of where the charts are, and it gives you, like, the number ones on all the big ones. At the very bottom, though, is a little tiny square. It says number 1 on this week's unpublished charts. So it's clearly the charts they didn't publish in this specific issue. I think some charts rolled from issue to issue, so like they would be featured maybe once a month instead of every single issue. They probably didn't change often enough for them to justify publishing it every time, but
I imagine if they were relevant to any articles that they were running in an issue, they would include those charts. Because I mean, I've seen the Contemporary Christian, you know, chart on other in other issues. So,
mm-hmm. So this one has, I'll just run through them real quick. We have the blues chart, and number one is Stevie Ray Vaughan, Double Troubles, The Real Deal Greatest Hits Volume 2. Contemporary Christian chart had The New Nation Project by Kirk Franklin. I remember that CD from Christian bookstores. It's like an orange photo of Kirk Franklin on the cover. Just like his head only. it's also the number. It's the number one on the gospel chart as well. The Kid Audio chart. Why would you really track this? But is Star Wars Episode One: The Phantom Menace's read along. So that's fun. A read along was number one.
Yeah, but this is June 1999.
Yeah.
The year the Phantom Menace came, or the month in the year that the Phantom Menace came out. It came out right at the beginning of June. Right?
Okay, I was wondering when it, what day of the month it came out in. So is it the beginning of the month? There's the Billboard Latin 50, and it is All My Hits, Todos Mi Existos by Selena. So that's an album chart there.
Oh, actually, it came out in mid-May.
So it had been out for long enough.
Yeah.
It's funny. I think there was a delayed reaction of Phantom Menace. There's a reference to it in, later in the issue, too. Yeah, Billboard Latin 50 is a Selena Greatest Hits, which that... I wonder if that has anything to do with our number one this week. I bet it does. The number or the music video chart, which is like the DVD VHS release of music related videos, so it could be a compilation or like a live concert or something along those lines, is Homecoming Live in Orlando by the Backstreet Boys. We'll be talking about them a lot. The reggae number one is Reggae Gold 1999 by various artists. It's one of those just genre compilations that were really popular in the late 90s. There were a ton of them at the time. The funk and disco ones were like the most popular ones.
I think I will listen to reggae this week. Let me go buy a reggae compilation CD.
Yeah, the most popular reggae songs of all time that this CD company was able to get a license for. And right. For world music, we got Sogno by Andrea Bocelli. So there he is. Good old Bocci. So we will actually go to our first chart, and we're kind of skipping ahead for a good reason. Yes. So
which will become apparent, I think, on the very next chart we do.
Yeah. So we are going to jump ahead and talk about the Billboard Hot 100. It's the centerpiece of the magazine. It's the thing that everyone comes to it for, in all reality.
But it is often in the missing pages file for different years, specifically because people ripped these pages out.
That shows you how much they like, you know, the Billboard Hot 100. If it's the most commonly ripped out portion of the magazine, it's the thing that people read Billboard for. So we're jumping all the way to the back. It's published in like page 95 or 96 of this issue, and it's 96. So we're doing this one first because you'll see there's a lot of repetition. So, and we didn't feel right talking about all these songs in all the other minor charts that they later appear on. And then when we get to the Hot 100, we're like, well, there's like one thing we haven't talked about. So we moved to the front, so we'll talk about these first. So number one this week, and as well as the week before and the 2 weeks prior, is If You Had My Love by Jennifer Lopez. Seventh week.
Yeah.
I need to tilt my screen back so I can see some more of the lettering. Is this the best Jennifer Lopez song?
Probably. I mean, it's the big one. Like, it's the song. It's the Jennifer Lopez song that made her a singer, because she was an actor before this.
Yeah, she gained a lot of notoriety by starring in the Selena movie. She had some other movie roles before her music career took off, but she also had a lot of other music as well. But yeah, this is like the one that kind of made her as far as mainstream success in the music business. I distinctly remember this music video the summer it came out. I actually remember a lot of these videos the summer they came out, because I think it was just one of those random occasions where we didn't have cable at our house, but our grandparents did. And it was one of those random occasions where we spent a chunk of time at our grandparents' house. And so we would watch MTV all day, VH1 all day, basically, because we had an older cousin who was often there, and that's what she wanted to watch. So, which I'm thankful for, because now I know all this stuff about. That's why I know all these songs so well.
Yeah.
Is it the biggest song? I think Jenny from the Block might be bigger. I wonder what her highest charting single is, though this was number one. So I guess that her page is alphabetical. Don't like that.
She had four number one hits, which would be I'm Real in 2001. Let's see. Ain't It Funny in 2002. This song in 99, and which it peaked at number one on June 11th. And then All I Have in 2003 was her other big number one single.
Weird.
10 top 10 hits, 32 charting songs.
And this is the one that kind of started it all. And it's the one I like the best. I can't really recall many other Jennifer Lopez songs. So. But she also kind of helped spring an interest in Latin music, which we'll see in a minute here.
Yeah, it's going to come up a lot in the charts in this issue. Yeah, I mean, she was definitely part of that moment, the Latin explosion of 1999. I mean, of the summer of 1999 specifically. I mean, because you look at everything else that came out. I have a couple little notes on the song that I thought were kind of interesting. It was originally almost going to be recorded by Michael Jackson. Which I'm really glad that he didn't, because it's a really good song, and I would rather hear her version than his, especially 1999 Michael Jackson.
Right.
Which he passed on it because he thought it was better suited to a woman, which, again, he's correct in that as well.
I don't even see how he could even sing this song, because it's very smooth, and like, I don't know if it's just the way that Jennifer Lopez performs it, but her singing is more like a constant note and not like that skippy, starty Michael Jackson type of singing.
Yeah, it would have been very different.
Yeah, dropping out hard sounds and only hitting, or vowels and only hitting the consonants. And
this song also has the real fun little Latin dance break in the middle of it, which comes out of nowhere, but it's fun. Because it's otherwise pretty like smooth, vaguely R&B pop single.
It's got more energy than a lot of the other R&B songs from 99, so I think that's why I appreciate it a little more. It's probably why it took off as well, too.
Also, I saw this, I thought it was weird. The Dark Child remix of this song uses a little bit of auto-tune on her voice, and it apparently is what specifically inspired T-Pain to go all in on auto-tune robot voice. And it's funny that it's this song and not another song that we'll talk about later that prominently uses auto-tune.
Yeah. Moving on to number two.
Yeah.
Okay, and number two, we have Last Kiss by Pearl Jam, the highest ranking Pearl Jam single of all time, the best-selling, which is so funny.
That's so weird. This Wayne Cochran cover.
That was a Wayne Cochran song that was made famous by J. Frank Wilson of the Cavaliers, covered by a Canadian band in the 70s called Wednesday. Pearl Jam. They had the biggest hit version of the song. It was a charity single as well, so like all the money went towards some like Kosovo refugees, I believe, or victims of, you know, the military thing we did there. it's so funny because despite it not really, it's not really a Pearl Jam song. It has a weird production to it. Is it live? It always felt like it was live.
It may have been recorded in studio live. It feels very much like an off the cuff recording. Definitely doesn't feel like a song that was intended to be a hit single. It just happened to be really successful, which it made me think, like, how much do they hate that this song was the most successful? Like, oh, we did that goofy song and it was our biggest single. Like,
because it is one of the things I think of the most when I think of Pearl Jam vocally, at least Eddie Vedder's voice. I think of the song Jeremy, and then I think of that's like the number two thing I think of when I think of Pearl Jam.
As much as I generally don't care for Pearl Jam, this is one of the songs by them I can kind of stand. Maybe just because it's a decent song in its own right. That being said, I do prefer the Wayne Coggan version. It is better.
It is. I like it better, too, than the J. Frank Wilson version. So, yeah, Wayne Coggan, which, look up a picture of Wayne Coggan if you haven't ever seen him.
I was about to say, do yourself a favor.
You want a good laugh. Yeah, it's like a morbid song about, you know, a couple in a car accident, and the girl dies in the car accident, which was apparently, like, part of a genre of music that existed in the 60s. A lot of songs like that.
Yeah, I mean, the tragic doo-wop single.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, it's the 90s, and they're so confused about decades and genres and styles and trends. It didn't even occur to me until I got through the rest of this issue how much this song fits. Because I thought, it's really weird that this doo-wop-y 50s, 60s sounding song cover is so successful, but it totally makes sense with all of the retro, vintage, pseudo 50s, which seems overplayed in 1999, if you're aware of those trends in the 90s, but it shows up again.
In a big way. Let's go to number three. It is Ricky Martin by Ricky Martin. That's not right. It is number three. It is Livin' La Vida Loca by Ricky Martin. The best Ricky Martin song.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. I remember it was so cool to hate Livin' La Vida Loca, but it's such a catchy song. Why would you ever want to hate this song?
My first note on this song is there's a reason this goofy ass song was so successful. Like, it's super goofy, but it's so good. Like, it's just an earworm. It's so catchy. And Ricky Martin's great. Like, he sounds great. Like, he's energetic and fun to watch. The music video is super fun.
Yeah, very kinetic. And, like, compared to a lot of the other, like, Latin artists that explode in the summer of 99, he's having the most fun out of all of them. Like, this isn't a ballad, which a majority of his other biggest hits were, like, ballady songs, which in Latin America is typically what sells really well. But this song is just, like, a blast to listen to. I don't remember why anyone hated it. I mean, well, I'm sure homophobia is probably
a lingering homophobia. I watched the video twice yesterday, but the second time with Katie, my wife, and she was like, how did we not know? Like, well, we were nine. That's how we didn't know. But everyone else.
Right. It's funny. I had that exact same thought watching that video. I was like, wow. It was, I don't know why it was a secret. I mean, I know why it was a secret, but yeah, not a very well kept secret, I imagine. Yeah, which is unfortunate. You kind of wish he could have just been out for way longer than he could have, but you know, the culture did not accept it. We're worldwide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is a huge song. I mean, this is the song that really launched the Latin explosion. Like, it created a whole awareness of another very large culture to American mainstream audiences. It's really important for that. The song is also a trendsetter in a couple of other less obvious ways that I do want to mention. This song is really important, or a really early instance of the loudness of pop music. The way this song was recorded and produced, and the way the dynamics are compressed, make this sound really, makes it perceived as much louder than it is in terms of like decibel level. And this is a really, really early song in that loudness war, is what it's referred to as, and the way that that escalated through the 2000s into everything getting more and more compressed and really fatiguing to listen to. It's pretty tasteful here, but this song was also recorded entirely in Pro Tools. It was like all direct into Pro Tools, no EQ on his vocals. They were just run through a compressor with a pretty high ratio and then straight into Pro Tools, and which is shows you how good his tone is. He's a really strong vocalist.
I mean, he's basically yelling the song too.
True.
But to do it without like cracking your voice and like ruining it is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, he's belting the whole time pretty much. But yeah, no, this was the first number one single with no conventional recording equipment. An entirely digital. I read a pretty interesting article, if you want to get more technical on it, where they talk about the whole production of it. But it was basically pieced together like a demo. And then he came and recorded a bunch of different takes. They comped his vocals together. And it's essentially from the first tracks that they laid, that's the end song. They didn't go back and re-record anything else after they had their vocals, which is pretty interesting.
Moving on to number four, we have No Scrubs by TLC. The third week on the, it was the 19th week it was on the chart. Previous week it was number three. It'd been out for a little bit at this point, which we'll see some reactions to in a little bit. This song felt like it came out later than it did in my memory. I don't know if it's because they were kind of ahead of the curve when it came to what pop music would later become, or if they were just like the trendsetters for what a majority of like Hot 100 pop music is going to sound like in the next couple years. But this song is another monster hit. It was off their, which album was it?
I don't know. Was this the second or third album? Yeah, it's an all-time hit. Like, you know this song.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to play it. You can sing the first verse. You know? Yeah, it's a great song.
It really is.
And it's crazy. Not even as much of it, as big of a song this is, it's still not overplayed to me. No. I can get just as much enjoyment out of it now.
It came out on Fan Mail, the 1999 album.
Okay.
Which was like the follow-up to Crazy, Sexy, Cool. So, and it had a couple other, it had another really big hit that shows up very soon.
It stayed in the top 10 for 17 weeks. In the top 10 Hot 100 for 17 weeks.
Yeah. It had lasting power. It's one of the longer running hits in the top 10. There's a couple others that are in there a little longer.
But yeah. It's not even the biggest song of 1999. This is a huge year.
Yeah, this is a really, really big year. Moving on.
Yeah.
Number five is Where My Girl's At by 702. I had actually forgotten about 702. They were a Missy Elliott project. Basically, like she produced their album, or at least the song, and she helped kind of get them where they were at. From the beat, you can pretty much tell right away that it's a Missy Elliott song. It was originally intended for TLC, but they rejected it. This is 702's biggest hit. I'm surprised to see it actually at number five. I don't know if it's just the power of Missy Elliott combined with some, you know, the TLC draw is why it did so well. Though it has been on the chart for 9 weeks at this point. It was number four the week before, number five the week before that. So it kind of stayed pretty highly up there. I wonder if this is one that benefited from MTV rotation, because I do remember the video being on.
Yeah, I don't know this song. I didn't recognize it from hearing it. But I mean, all of the things that you said, like it being originally intended as a TLC song, it sounds very much like it was intended to be a TLC song. The Missy Elliott production, it very much sounds like a Missy Elliott production. I mean, that beat that the syncopation that they use, the string hits, the shamisen in Japanese like lute instrument that is shows up on a lot of these songs, I think, was very trendy at the time and very much a staple of Missy Elliott's sound. It makes sense why this was successful. I am surprised that it's such a high number for a song that I don't remember, though.
Yeah, it is funny
that is always odd.
I wonder if it dropped off not too long after this, and maybe that's why. It probably lost some traction thanks to another TLC song. Yeah, they didn't really. It was their biggest hit. They never had another hit come close to this. So it's interesting that Missy Elliott magic. Do you want to talk about the greatest gainer right there?
Yeah, we don't have to dig too deep on that one. I do have some notes on it, though. The greatest gainer in sales is at number 11 on the charts. It's Not Right, But It's Okay by Whitney Houston. A lesser known Whitney Houston hit, I would say. I think that's accurate. I definitely didn't know it.
No.
It's pretty good. I really like the kalimba that they use in the song. It reminds me a lot of something by Earth, Wind, and Fire. It's just like a really nice, pleasant sounding background effect on the song. Otherwise, she does, towards the end, she does her like, ooh, her little riffing in between the main hook, and it feels silly considering it's like a minor key and like kind of a heavy song lyrically. It's a little of an odd choice, which I think it kind of drags it down.
It's funny that they consider what makes something a great gainer, because this was number 17 the week before and it's number 11 on this week. It doesn't seem like a gigantic leap. Is it anytime anybody over 5?
Let me see if I can find that explanation in the fine print at the bottom of the chart. Greatest gainer sales and greatest gainer airplay are awarded respectively for the largest sales and airplay increases on the chart. So it's just the largest.
Oh, for that week.
Sale increase for that week. Okay. Out of all of the songs on this chart.
Well, then that'll lead us to the greatest gainer in airplay at number 38, which is Beautiful Stranger by Madonna. Previously number 55. I don't know this song.
You would know it if you hear it. This is, I loved finding these songs in this issue. This is a soundtrack song.
Is it for the Austin Powers soundtrack?
It is. I remember this song really well. I don't remember it being anything related to Austin Powers, but the music video, it is a direct Austin Powers tie-in. It's ridiculous. The na-na-na little chorus tag that she does at the end and the little flute solo are very, they make a lot of sense when you consider it as being the Austin Powers tie-in, because it's na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, like that 60s, like you can just imagine someone playing that melody on an organ in like a Doors song.
I completely forgot. I remember that video distinctly because it's full of Austin Powers. He's in the video like the whole time.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Which apparently getting a song on that soundtrack was supposedly a bloodbath. one of the co-writers, producers of the song says, this song was written for the movie. Madonna co-wrote it. It's been compared to She Comes in Colors by Love, also famously maybe better known as being covered by the Rolling Stones, which Madonna, and the melody is very similar. The vocal melody is very similar to the original, which Madonna claims she's never even heard of Love, or had never heard of Love, which is kind of surprising. If you're going to try and write psych pop for an Austin Powers movie, you'd think you would know Love.
What is the big Love song? Is that the song you mentioned? There's like one really big Love song.
That one's pretty big. It's not the one. My Little Red Book was by Love, which I guess we probably know that one better for being in the High Fidelity soundtrack.
I guess that's probably the one that I'm thinking of.
There's something on the album Forever Changes. It's a big, let me find it.
Alone Again Or?
Yeah, I probably know that one, but I can't tell you what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is very much, this is club, club single Madonna era.
Yeah, this was like her last, I guess Music was probably like the last like relevant single that she had that was like a big, big deal.
Yeah, Music's bigger, definitely, than this song.
Moving along. So now we're entering into the new entries, and the hotshot debut for this issue is at number 63, and it is I Could Not Ask For More. I Could Not Ask For More. I don't know why I always read that wrong. By Edwin McCain. I forgot about Edwin McCain. These Are the Moments song that is his most lasting song.
Does he have anything else?
He could not ask for more.
My first note on this, is this Christian music? It's got that sound.
This is adult contemporary music is what this is.
Yeah, which is almost the same thing.
Albie is his other song.
Oh. Why do I know two Edwin McCain songs? Yeah, it's McCain. He looks like, have you looked at a picture of him recently? Or, well, not recently, but whenever this song came out. Did you watch the music video for it?
I watched the music video for it.
Who does he look like?
The guy from Soul Asylum. He looks like most guys in the 90s with long blonde hair over the age of 30.
I have a note that says Sean Astin with long hair. He looks, but more specifically, he looks like a guy I can't think of his name, and I can't think of what I even know him from, but he's like a comedic actor who is like not Mitch Hedberg, but the same kind of thing, like stoner comedy guy, and I can't think of what he's even in, but if someone makes the connection, please look it up. Please tell me. Because it's bugging me.
He looks like Jack Black in High Fidelity.
A little bit. Yeah. This was also a soundtrack song.
What, from what?
Message in a Bottle.
Oh.
Yeah. The Kevin Costner movie.
Moving along to the next new entry is number 76 with Unpretty by TLC. Now, this is the other TLC song that I was talking about. Scrubs is the monster hit, but Unpretty, I think I like better from just like a pure songwriting stance. I don't know. I really enjoyed this song. It's sort of a mid-paced song for them. It's a little more subtle. It's not as over the top like No Scrubs is. We're focused on the melody and not so much like, I feel like the rap was a bigger part of No Scrubs.
Yeah, this song didn't do a whole lot for me. I prefer No Scrubs. I do want to talk about the music video, though, because it does the thing that so many 1999 music videos did. It has this superfluous, like, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't relate to the song or very much else in the video intro of them, like, hacking into or, like, logging into a computer into their secret lair. There's so many of these like Matrix hacker computer technology sci-fi things in music videos in 1999. I mean, the Jennifer Lopez the music video we didn't talk about has like it the whole thing is like a voyeur webcam.
You know, that was right, that was Jamie Kennedy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hacking into her webcam? Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, it's like it's her...
home security?
Home security, but, like, she knows because she's, like, dancing suggestively for it.
It's like, don't dance for Jamie Kennedy!
And then they're, like, broadcasting it. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, when we were talking about this issue originally, the first thing you said to me was, this issue is so digital! And you see it in all the ads, too. It's just this, like, hey, we figured out how to use computers in our ads. Everybody uses the exact same, like, textured backgrounds for their boring-ass ads. At number 80 is The Secret of Life by Faith Hill.
I have one other note on Unpretty. Sorry. I do want to throw in. I didn't see this, but I have in my notes, it's no waterfalls or no scrub. It sounds kind of like Hanson.
It does have the little, like, acoustic guitar twinkly thing, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the melody. The melody is very Hanson-y. Anyway, let's move on.
The verse, yeah. Yeah, that's true. The video also has, like, this whole, like, love yourself thing going on, which is cool, I guess. I don't know if that's necessarily what the lyrics are about, but, you know, it's not unusual for a music video to not have anything to do with the actual song. Okay, number 80. The new entry, it is The Secret of Life by Faith Hill. For some reason, I thought Faith Hill was much later than this. I wasn't familiar with this song at all, which is funny because it was a mainstream hit song. And, like, it crossed into the top 100.
Yeah, this was a big surprise for me. I don't know this song. I'm not very familiar with Faith Hill other than her other big crossover hit. And when I heard it, I really thought that this was just carried into the mainstream by the success of Breathe, but it was not. Breathe came out later in 1999. So this was a crossover hit for her before her obvious crossover hit, which makes a ton of sense because that song sounds like a pop song. This sounds like country.
Yeah. Yeah. It is more country than Breathe is by a long shot, which... Country was having a moment in 99 as well, which we'll talk about when we get to the country charts.
Yeah, it's my only other thoughts on this. It's originally a Gretchen Peters song. I'm not very familiar with her. Though she did do a cover of I Ain't Ever Satisfied by Steve Earle. That's pretty good. She falls more in, like, the Americana songwriter circle of Nashville in the 90s. But that being said, this is a pretty good song.
It's a pretty upbeat song. I think I can handle the 90s country music more when it's upbeat. Ballads in country music in the 90s, I am not here for, but
we'll get there.
Yeah, it's not bad. Okay, moving on to number 82, also new to this week. It is Jigga My N-Word. I'm not going to say that. by Jay-Z. This was interesting. So, obviously, Billboard magazine did not censor the word, which I guess is fine in a...
Yeah, I mean...
When it's what it's called, you write it out.
I had to type it to search for it.
Like, right. Which is fine. It's what the name of the song is. It's just, we're not allowed to say it. But the song is from the Rough Riders album, which was a compilation that we'll talk about it in a little bit, too. But it was a compilation from DMX's record label, Rough Riders. And it's like, it's full of all sorts of different musicians. And it shows up on a chart later, and I'll talk about the rest of the musicians on there. But is this Jay-Z's first, like, really big hit? And even then, is it that big of a hit? I know this song. I knew this song before. I need to look at his other singles from this time period.
Can I Get A came out in earlier in 99. Hard Knock Life came out earlier.
Is it In My Lifetime? Or actually on the album Hard Knock Life?
Let's see. He was on his way up at this point.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, anything before 1999 charts pretty low for him, down in, like, the 50s. I mean, this one wasn't as successful as his earlier singles from 1999.
Yeah.
It peaked at 28 in September. So it kind of crawled its way up to its peak.
I'm wondering if its title was actually part of what slowed its descent. I don't imagine a lot of top 40 radio was playing this. You'd hear it on the rap stations, I'm sure, but unless it was like a heavily edited radio version, I don't think you would have heard it on like a top 40. the DJs couldn't say the name of it.
Yeah.
God, I hope they didn't. God.
It's very unbroadcastable for mainstream pop radio standards. What do you think of the song?
It's not bad. It's got a... The beat's weird. He sounds great, but the beat is odd. It just feels, I don't know, digital. It all sounds like ones and zeros.
Well, it's a Swizz beat.
Yeah.
I'm kind of opposite of you. I like the beat in this song more than his performance. I've never been able to get into him. He's just he's too locked in. He's too consistent from song to song. He does every song the same. I mean, just the way he gets his into like every single song. It's just never really. I get why people love him, and his lyrics are really, really good. That's probably the most important part. But I really like the production of it. I like that key sound. It's really in your face. it sounds like you can hear the keys on the keyboard clicking, and the snare has this really harsh white noise, like computer, like an NES kind of drum beat sound that I thought was nice. But otherwise, the hook and most of his performance doesn't do much for me.
Okay. At number 94, we have Watch Out Now by the Beatnuts featuring Yellow Claw. Who? So this one's weird too to me, like that it even charted, because I have no memory of the song whatsoever. The Beatnuts were a New York hip hop group. This song has a an Enoch Light sample.
Hi, Chad.
The Beatnuts were part of the Native Tongues Collective, which featured De La Soul and A Tribe Called Quest, which I totally get those vibes for listening to this song, which is funny because it's like you don't think of them in 99.
Yeah, that makes stylistically that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it's they pale in comparison.
Right. I'm not entirely sure why this song was such a big hit, because it did well on the rap charts as well. But I don't know.
It's just that Hijack sample.
It could be. I mean, a good beat can elevate a song from obscurity. But yeah, it's worth mentioning. It's also worth mentioning that Jennifer Lopez also used the same sample in Jenny from the Block, which was apparently controversial because the Beatnuts were mad about it because they think it was like their particular beat that she was using. Like they sampled the song and then they just used their sample of it instead of coming up with a new one. So they were pretty mad about that, but it was their only big hit. I could see why. We have a re-entry at number 96, and it's She's a Bitch by Missy Elliott. Just reminds me of how good Missy Elliott is. The beat's amazing. It's got this cool like bongo, like a rolling bongo. It's just like four fingers on the top of a bongo rolling, and it's got like a synth sax and like a neat little piano line. It's not one of the Missy Elliott songs I really recognize, but I do remember the video pretty distinctly. It's one of those Hype Williams videos.
Yeah, the video is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. She's got like six costumes or something like that in that video, which most of her videos from that time period were like that.
Yeah,
it's like shot in black and white in a lot of places.
It's her aesthetic was both on trend and cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was, she did all of that black leather, high tech, hacker, goth stuff, and she did it really well. It just looks really cool and really timeless. I mean, there's a reason people reference her iteration of those styles whenever mm-hmm. they're trying to capture that look. This song isn't one of the better singles from this time period, but it's strong.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first single from her second album.
It was a re-entry.
Yeah. Which I'm always curious what was driving a re-entry, because is there much else on here from her?
She shows up again, I believe. Maybe the 702, because it's all the way up there at number 5. That's what pushed its re-entry back in, because that's very clearly her beat too. So
yeah, it would make sense to play these songs
mm-hmm.
close together.
Yeah, and like a listening block. Or, like, if you went to the store and you were buying, like, just singles, which I guess maybe people were doing. I don't know about 99.
Yeah.
Like, albums were what everybody was listening to, but... Which, unless
these are sound scan. She doesn't have any other singles on this chart. Yeah, so this is as good a time as any to point out that the way Billboard charts are compiled, I'm very skeptical of their honesty. The way SoundScan works is, I mean, it's Byzantine. Like, it's such a complex system that goes into ranking Billboard charts and taking SoundScan data and Nielsen data, and you almost wonder if they're just like, make that one number 99 this week, you know? Just a guesstimate when they're looking at the numbers. I'd like to find an article that maybe goes in depth. I'm going to do some research before our next singles action episode to try and get a better grasp on how these charts are actually compiled. Because everyone references the charts, but you don't always know what they mean.
Right.
And the re-entries, that really has me wondering. Like, it really sold that much less the week before this? And then suddenly started selling better? Like, and I mean, the Hot 100 is compiled from both airplay and sales?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's strange.
Yeah. Yeah. The airplay plus sales. It's like, why not just do one? I don't understand why your Hot 100 is comprised of multiple different formulas for determining.
Right. And then there's also, which we'll get into soon, separate airplay and singles sales.
Yeah.
Charts.
Let's do our last one before
let's hit the last one on the Hot 100.
So the last new entry is at number 99 and is Let Me Know by Cam'ron. It's most notable for using the NFL Monday Night Football theme song as the sample.
What's it called? What's that song called? Heavy Action.
Bum, 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 bum.
At first, I thought it was really corny, but then at the end of the sample, when it connects to the beat and this first line, it was like, all right, that was good.
Yeah, Cam'ron, he's from New York hip hop. It's not a bad little song. It's kind of fun. I mean, that sample is probably the reason why it did so well, because it's just kind of funny to hear that. But yeah, it's not bad. It wasn't like a highly super notable song. It's definitely like one of the lesser hits of the era. But
it's kind of a Jay-Z diss track. There are apparently a couple of lines that are direct disses to Jay, and they feuded apparently. I liked the beat though, and I think he has a really good flow, and it's a pretty enjoyable single. So
he's still around too. Yeah. Still putting stuff out.
Yeah, I mean, I recognize his name. I'm not very familiar with him, but I definitely knew of him.
Yeah. All right, should we continue through the regular flow of the issue?
Sure.
So the next notable thing that I have here is a ad for Kid Rock's Devil Without a Cause going platinum. Fuck Kid Rock, by the way. It's a picture of him holding out his middle finger, which may be the back of the album cover artwork. I think that's what that's from. And it just says 1 million, with his finger being the one in the millions place. So, thanks. I don't know what that sentiment's supposed to be, but
he doesn't need it. He doesn't need your accolades. But the label is definitely going to pay to run an ad.
Right.
Congratulating themselves for the success of this record. Platinum. It came out in 99.
Yeah. That's how many CDs people were buying in 99, though. And nu metal was gigantic. Though our charts don't fully reflect that well, but...
Well, there's a big one when we get to the... Yeah. When we get there.
Yeah.
I feel like we keep doing that, but that's the nature of this magazine.
Yeah.
There's a lot of echoes throughout it.
Well, I don't have anything until page 12.
Yeah, let's go there.
Okay. On page 12, we have an article that says RCA's Verve Pipe finds new flow. So the Verve Pipe were releasing their follow-up album to their 96 record, which had Freshman on it, which was their biggest hit. It's a crazy thing that it was 3 years between that album and this one. So they took 3 years between albums and said it was because their producer was a perfectionist who made them do redos over and over and over again. They also talk about how the band members contributed writing songs. So I think it went from like the one guy writing all the songs to everyone writing songs. They went in a brighter, more pop-centric direction, and they were like, it's not as dark as our last album, and they expected it to do really well. The article also says they have a large internet following, so they're going to market harder towards the internet.
The internet.
Turns out, no one wanted that, because we were all listening to nu metal in 99. That producer, they blame the producer for the delay and what pushed them.
I can never keep the Verve pipe and the Verve separate in my mind.
The Verve or Bittersweet Symphony?
Okay.
Verve pipe or the Freshman.
Right. Which I think I know, but I can't place it.
Yeah. they blamed the producer for like, well, it took us so long because of the producer. I wonder how much that's true. How much of that is them just being like, ah, shit, I don't have the songs. But you can't.
One guy couldn't write enough songs, they started pulling from the rest of the band, and then you gotta weed through the weaker tracks from these not lead songwriters in the band.
I mean, that could be the case where they were just like, either he was out of ideas and it took forever to get ideas out of the other guys, or the producer, or they were just like, they came into it, or maybe the other guys of the band were like, we want to write songs. And so then the producer, yeah, you're right, had to weed through their, like, subpar recorded songs. And like, ugh.
The potential for a power struggle, too, within the group when you're incorporating different songwriters.
It's just, I listened to a couple samples from this record just to see what it sounded like. It had no big hit at all. Freshman is their only hit. It doesn't sound like the Freshman, which in 99, no one would have cared anyway. If it sounded like Freshman, you need to put out an album the year after. You can't wait 3 years for your very of the moment sound.
Yeah, it probably needed more down tuned guitars and or seven strings and scratches.
Yeah. So on the same page is a column called "The Beat" by Melinda Newman. I assume she wrote it every week because it's got her photo beside of it. And the headline is Meredith Brooks returns to high school to help teens through mentoring program. I don't really care so much about that as the close to the end of the column. It says Mbop Part 2. Hanson is in Los Angeles A&M Studios recording a new pop album with producer Rick Ocasek.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Of the Cars fame.
How does that work? Like, I need you to be more disaffected.
Hanson. who had just finished recording Guided by Voices TVT debut album.
See, that makes sense.
Yeah, that does. He says the pairing isn't as much of a stretch as it might initially seem. Hanson might seem like an off-the-wall project for me, but not really. You might even say that they are the other side of the coin from Guided by Voices, and that you can hear threads of 60s pop in both bands. They both really love music, and it's apparent in their heartfelt sound that each band has. Plus, songs are what get me, and believe me, Hanson has written some really good pop songs. In fact, it'll be hard to pick which 12 to do out of the 20 or so they came up with. They're extremely talented kids, real musicians. With Hanson, I'd like to bring a little edge to their sound while being careful to maintain just what they had that makes them what they are. The Hanson disc is due for fall release. Did that happen? When? What year did?
Was it this time around?
I need to look at like their release.
Because their 2000, nothing came out in November, or there nothing came out in the fall of 99 from them. Their next record came out in 2000, and it was produced by the band, Mark Hudson and Stephen Leroni. Nothing involving Rick Ocasek. So that means there's a Rick Ocasek produced Lost Hanson album.
I only hope that there is.
Which maybe it shows up somewhere else.
I don't know. If you search for Rick Ocasek on their Wikipedia page, there's no mention of him anywhere. So I wonder if they even got in and actually recorded anything.
Yeah, it's possible that they sent him demos and he's just like blowing smoke. He doesn't really have to have it locked in.
I thought that was pretty entertaining. So continuing the weirdness, if you move on to page 14, we have a gigantic article. It's Mikey Ramone and the Intruders keep punk spirit up with Rounder Set. So I'm amazed that Mark Yermone has this big of an article in Billboard in 1999. It's on their album, The Answer to Your Problems, which is produced by Lars Fredriksson of Rancid. I sampled some of the songs. It's not bad, but I don't know why they thought they should write such a big article for this album. It didn't have any hits. It's not even a well-known Ramones spinoff record. I feel like Marky's not... Who's more well-regarded as far as... I guess it is Marky. He's the one who kind of shows up in everybody else's bands. But I don't know that anyone even cares about Marky's solo music.
Which one is still touring?
Is that Richie?
I mean, Marky is still alive.
Mm-hmm. Marky's last album was 2008, though that doesn't mean he didn't tour.
It was, I want to say, either Marky or Richie toured not too long ago. I mean, he played some small places, though.
Yeah. I think it's Richie. I feel like I remember seeing Richie. I don't know. It's just a lot to talk about a Marky Ramone record in Billboard. This isn't like a punk magazine. I know the Ramones were huge, but they weren't.
Yeah, in 1999, it feels like people weren't revisiting the importance of the Ramones.
No. Continuing on to the next page is my favorite ad, I think, in the entire magazine. And it's an ad for Toy Box. And it's like this, it's the album cover for a Danish pop group, a Danish Eurodance group. Think Venga Boys and Aqua. I kind of fell down a rabbit hole with them and watched like four or five of their videos. They are like all Barbie Girl videos. It's just Barbie Girl done over and over again. One's about being Tarzan.
Yeah, they look very much like Aqua.
Yeah. Is a bald guy, right? No, he's not bald. He's got hair. And the whole like running joke with them is that the girl is in love with the guy, but the guy doesn't seem to care. And he's like with other girls the whole time. It runs through all of their videos. It's not just a one-time video thing. Yeah, I just thought this was... They got a gigantic full-page ad. Full color. I don't know. Spin Music and Adele? Yeah, it's very, very odd. I don't know. It's funny.
It looks like Spy Kids.
And moving forward, there's one of those funny digital ads for Warner Music. It's just, the ad itself isn't funny. It's just the background is just like pixelated blue and black background. It's just very much like, you would hate to see that in anything now.
Yeah, it's really bad quality. It took a long time. For people to fully grasp what they could do with computers in graphic design.
On page 19, there's another ad I wanted to point out. It's for Mr. Oizo. And I don't know, did you happen to listen to Mr. Oizo?
No.
So the ad is, it's a little puppet guy. And it's an ad for like his number one, like the song is a number one platinum in UK, Germany, Belgium, gold in Italy, Norway, Austria, you know, all that kind of stuff. The song, I think it's called Flat Beat. At the top it says, wah, 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 you know, like that. It goes on. Mm-hmm. That is the song. There's no words. It's this puppet just making like wow, 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 wow noises. But I love the video because it's this puppet guy in an office doing office things. So he like calls his receptionist in to like do hand in papers. He signs papers. He's smoking a giant cigar. He makes phone calls. It's just a puppet behind a desk. And it's probably my favorite music video of all time. Just like Eurodance stuff. It's just so silly. But
yeah.
The 90s, man. Crazy. Okay, now we have a chart.
Yes.
We are on page 20, if you're following along at home, and it is the Billboard's Heatseekers album chart. This is something that people still claim today. Anytime a band's record goes on the Heatseekers chart, you'll see a tweet or a post about it on Instagram or you know something along those lines, a Facebook post. Still, it really just means it sold a lot of copies.
Well, there are rules.
Yes, strict rules.
The Heatseekers chart, and this is probably why it's so important, because it's a chart that signifies that a band or an artist has broken through
to the mainstream.
They are now a mainstream artist.
Mm-hmm. So we can just read the rule, basically. The Heatseekers chart lists the best-selling titles by new and developing artists, defined as those who have never appeared in the top 100 of the Billboard 200 chart. When an album reaches this level, the album and the artist's subsequent albums are immediately ineligible to appear on the Heatseekers chart. So this is a one-time thing, and you have to get in the 100, not the 200. So it just signifies that it's the first time this artist released or sold that many copies to justify. There's not even a number limit, because now people aren't buying music the same way they were in 99. So it's just a comparison to the rest of the albums that are on the album chart. So number one is Shadazy with The Whole Shebang. Good old Shadazy trying to capitalize on the popularity of the Dixie Chicks and Shania Twain. I watched a video from this record. There's brown face in it, so that's cool.
Topical.
Yeah. It's pop country in the most pop sense. Yeah. We don't have to spend a ton of time on these albums, but we'll name a couple more here. Number two is the Low Fidelity All-Stars, How to Operate with a Blown Mind. I had to look up who the Low Fidelity All-Stars were. They're this weird, electronic group. I don't know why it did so well. It's got a Fatboy Slim vibe to it, which might be why it did well. Number three is the Moffats with Chapter One, A New Beginning. That's also a new entry. They were the Canadian Hanson. They were a teenage boy rock group. Pretty bad.
Yeah, the Moffats, this record's not on Spotify.
No. That shows you.
They are on Spotify. Everything else they had done after that.
Number four is Oleander with their album February Sun. Do you remember Oleander?
Vaguely.
So this is my lane. The obscure alternative rock hit that no one else remembers, I remember. So Oleander were getting a lot of radio play on our local rock station. They were a post-grunge band whose song Why I'm Here got a lot of traction. I found a video of them playing Woodstock 99, which is the famous horror show. and it kind of shows you the exact type of rock band that was playing during the daytime at Woodstock 99. They're in the vein of Bush and Fuel, that kind of post-grunge thing.
Right. Oh, yeah. They have one of these songs shows up on the mainstream rock charts.
Mm-hmm.
So we can, I have some notes on there and we can save it for later. Or
okay. We'll save the rest for later, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm putting it together. Number five, also new on the chart, is Delirious and their record Mesomorphosis.
Delirio 5? Question mark. Because the S is a question is a 5. Christian rock band from the UK. Their fans called this a sellout record because they went secular. It's really just bad Christian Oasis is what it is.
Yeah, it's really bad Britpop.
They were a band that I remember seeing in the Christian bookstores growing up all the time. And I even distinctly remember playing, for those unfamiliar with a Christian music store, during the 90s and 2000s, they have listening stations, which are literally just stereos, and you just take the whole thing and put it in. Kind of like when you go to a record store where you can just put the record on the turntable, see how it sounds. They did this for CDs and tapes, too, which is such a bad idea. Why would you ever allow that? But in a Christian store, most people don't know what anything sounds like in there.
Yeah.
Especially in the rock and metal section. So they have to be just let them hear what it sounds like, and maybe they'll buy this $19 CD. And
so they also famously printed their little guides saying, if you like this secular artist, you'll love these Christian artists.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, I guess if you weren't familiar with the secular artists, that wasn't helpful.
Yeah, there were some weird ones on there, too, that I remember being like, I don't know who the secular artist is.
Yeah. I guess the labels submitted those. I wonder if there were bands that were just like, yeah, put this obscure band in there for us.
they never really appealed to me. I even remember listening to like some of the samples, like the either like on the cassette or like the CD, and I would sample them, and I would they were never enough for me to be like, I want to buy this. Yeah, not good. They were like bad Newsboys, if that means anything to anyone. There's some other new entries on the Heatseekers chart, so we'll kind of run through these fast. We don't really need to spend a ton of time. At number six is Ibrahim Ferrer? Yes. Ferrer? I don't know. Buena Vista Social Club presents Ibrahim Ferrer. It's a solo record from one of the members of the Buena Vista Social Club. Kind of a cool thing. It's probably the only reason why he hasn't appeared on here before is because he hadn't done solo stuff. Maybe. I don't know. Number eight is Chibo Matto, which is a weird New York trip-hop group featuring two Japanese expatriates. Mm-hmm. So they're like rapping and singing, and like their broken English. It's very interesting. I don't know why it was on here, but...
Well, so this is their second record. This is their first record, including Sean Lennon. John Lennon's son.
Oh, wow.
Why it's on here.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's called Stereotype A. I listened to a little bit of it. I could see why someone would like it, but it is just odd that it made this big of an impact. Number 11 is Orbital with The Middle of Nowhere, which is seems like it's super late to be putting Orbital songs or albums on the Heatseekers charts, but I guess no one cared about Orbital. Trance music? Is that what you would call that? Electronic? Industrial? Sort of industrial? I don't know.
Orbital were, yeah, techno.
Yeah.
I think techno is the proper classification.
Number 14 is just the Irish Tenors. They actually named each one individually, but no one knows them outside of the Irish Tenors. Number 25 is the London Suede with their album Head Music. London Suede, they're a Britpop group who go by the name Suede in the UK. Yeah. So this is one of those English beat situations where there's another band in the US with the same name.
Yeah, this was, I have this marked as the dregs of Britpop.
It's a post-Oasis Britpop world. and that's really the only other thing of note on there.
There's the Tal Bachman record, self-titled album.
Mm-hmm. Was She So High?
I wanted to mention that because She's So High shows up on multiple charts, but due to our focus on the top fives and new entries, we don't ever touch that one. So I just want to throw that one out there. This is the summer of She's So High. There's a Brad Paisley record on here.
Oh, yeah. So that means this is his first big record.
There's also
a Sonic Flood.
Flood record.
Self-titled. You own that one.
I did.
And I bought the sheet music for it when we were learning how to play guitar.
I wonder if I still have that. Probably stuck in my Mars Music guitar bag.
Leanne Womack has one on there. Some Things I Know.
Shakira's on here.
Really?
Yeah, at number 21.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize she was making it.
So, again, more of the Latin explosion. This is her first big record.
Yeah. Below that is the Popular Uprisings column, which focuses on upcoming artists with like good prospects, basically. I wouldn't normally mention this, but since we are primarily a punk podcast, we do venture out into weird stuff every now and then. I wanted to mention any time anything punk-related sort of shows up in a Billboard magazine. So in this column, we have a reference to the Donna's new Lookout Records album produced by Jeff and Steve McDonald from Red Cross. I sampled a little bit of it, and it's like straight up Ramones core. Like, the Donna's had more of a 70s... Wait, I guess the Ramones were 70s. But more like a glam rock vibe, musically, or like a power pop vibe.
That.
And
yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Strokes.
The post-punk revival, I guess, is what they call it, but it's not really post-punk. I don't know.
But yeah, they started as like a Ramones core band on Lookout Records, which is just, it's just funny to see a reference to the Donnas before the Donnas were relevant. So it's odd. And in this article, which there's a bigger article about them later, but it talks up as a little write-up about Sinsfield, self-titled album that was due to be released in July, getting pushed back to October. I could save it for later. There's another article later in the issue that's more in depth on them specifically, but I figured I'd mention that. There's some album reviews on page 22. Nothing really. There's a Gangstar record but it's like a best of Gangstar record.
Yeah, the album reviews in Billboard magazines, they always seem like weird choices for album reviews.
Yeah, I don't know why they pick them or how they pick them.
And probably one of the bigger ones is Sparrow by Stephen Curtis Chapman.
Yeah.
I'm sure I know songs from it, but I'm not invested in finding out which ones.
There's on the singles review page, there's a review for Garbage's When I Grow Up, which is interesting. It was like a weird new pop mix that they were reviewing.
There's also a single review for There She Goes, the Sixpence None the Richer.
Yeah, it's the cover of The Laws, right?
Yes.
Have you noticed an increase of people playing The Laws version on the radio now?
The inferior?
I was going to say.
Yeah.
This is one
I
of those.
I have noticed that. It shows up on like radio station, like if you use anything like Pandora or whatever, or I'm sure on Spotify playlists as well.
Those like algorithmically determined playlists will have it on there, and it's like nowhere near as good as the Sixpence None the Richer version.
Yeah,
his voice is obnoxious. It's grating.
Yeah, give me Lane Ash.
Yeah. In the home video review section under general media, there's one for the unauthorized Star Wars story, and it's just a documentary about the making of the original Star Wars movies using interview footage of the actors. This was clearly selling very well because of Phantom Menace, but it's like this unauthorized release that they're making or writing a review for. It's odd. I mean, I guess you can make something unauthorized without the permission or the approval, I guess, of George Lucas, and it still be legit media, but it's just an odd little thing.
Yeah, I mean, you could, it's reporting, you know, you can do it.
Yeah.
I can't stop you. As long as you don't say anything factually inaccurate.
Right. Okay, so we'll move on to another chart. We're going to do the Hot Rap Singles chart, which you messaged earlier. You're like, I have so many notes.
And I don't really know most of these songs.
No. So the number one song is No Pigeons by Sporty Thieves featuring Mr. Woods.
Not a franchise. Not a shot caller. Yeah, Sporty Thieves.
Sporty Thieves.
Not a.
A pigeon is a girl who be walking by. My rimmed up blue, brand new sparkling five. Her feet hurt, so you know she wanna ride. But she front like she can't say hi. What? Uh-oh.
Y'all chicks ain't getting nada.
Uh-oh.
Your pussy ain't worth the Ramada.
Uh-oh.
Anyway, your friend looks hotter.
Uh-oh.
Game is something we got a lot of. Uh-oh.
Cause I don't want no pigeon to be them girls who gets no ducks from me. Playing the bar dumb broke where the best friends go. Trying to holler at me. I don't want no pigeon to be them girls who gets no ducks from me. Playing the bar dumb broke where the best friends go. Trying to holler at
me. In front of the club, I see this girl like your love. Thought she said thug, but she called me a scrub. Scrub? What? She must have tucked me
joke. It was number 17 the week before. It's the second week on the charts. This is a... What do you call this? A diss track for TLC's No Scrubs?
A parody?
Yeah?
Yes, it is a response.
Mm-hmm.
A satirical response to TLC's hit No Scrubs. It need to be done.
No. Yeah, I don't know why they did that. I don't know who Sporty Thieves are. This probably is their biggest thing they did. Why it sold well. Is it just because No Scrubs was so new, and it's like you're already parodying something?
Yeah, it was of the moment.
And features, it's the name of the their names are hilarious. King Kirk, aka Thieven Steelberg. Yeah, I didn't really like it. It's kind of a gross song, so I just was like, all right, whatever.
Yeah, I moved on quickly.
Yeah. Number two, I did enjoy a little bit more, is Who Dat by JT Money featuring Soleil. I know Who Dat.
It was so familiar.
Yeah. It mainly the chorus.
Yeah.
Where it's just them saying Who Dat, Who Dat, Who Dat, Who Dat a lot.
The Soleil verse is really good.
Yeah.
I think that's the high point of the song.
Yeah.
They collaborated on a song on Hurt Record, Skin Deep as well. the song 4, 5, 6. This song peaked at number 5 on the Hot 100.
Surprising. This was its 11th week.
Number 3 is Let Me Know by Cameron, which we talked about. Number 4 is Holla Holla by Ja Rule. Yes, Firefest's Ja Rule. This was his debut single. A little bit behind the scenes about this one. He recorded his album. Def Jam made him go back in the studio and write a single because they didn't think he had a hit on there.
Yeah.
And even
this, into a hit.
Yeah, I mean, it was a hit, but at the same time, I don't think it's even his best hit. It's the one with Holla Holla with his raspy voice. And
yeah, I have it. A note that says Ja Rule's all right. His voice is just mental sandpaper. It's just so raw. But that hook is good. It's memorable.
Yeah, for a reason. It's memorable. Who Dat and Holla Holla. I mean, that's pretty memorable. I wasn't really tapped into hip-hop in 99, so if I remember it now, it must have been kind of a big deal. Number 5 is one we've already seen. It is Watch Out Now by the Beatnuts featuring Yellow Claw. Some new entries. We have, this is one I missed the write-up. At number 16, we have Breaker Breaker by GZA the Genius from the Wu-Tang Clan.
This is not a test, it's difficulty. Picture closely, the ignorant mostly. Blind, deaf, dumb, your mind left numb. Lost soul, who failed to hear the roll of the drum. In the bottom of your bomb shelter, still felt the heavy blast that blew off the mass of 12 welders. The math of an elder. Praise the Lord, thank you, genius.
Operation this Project. This was from English. His third solo album, Beneath the Surface, which was a follow up to the iconic Liquid Swords record.
This one's pretty good. Liquid Swords. And GZA and kind of by extension Wu-Tang, I have immense respect for, but I don't get a ton out of listening to them. This song is really has a really sparse production, produced by Arabian Night. It's a pretty good song, but there's something about them that they're very esoteric and overly complex, and it's really hard to connect with a lot of their music for me in any emotional way. It's very, I have a very surface level appreciation for their sound, their production, and some of their lyrical turns, but I've never really been hooked. I know why people love them, but there's always just something about them that I've been lukewarm on.
I think they work better together. As far as solo rappers go, Ghostface might have the most consistent career overall. Though I could see people like Raekwon or even GZA. Like Cuban Lynx and Liquid Swords are probably more iconic than any Ghostface solo records. I guess ODB is probably the one who would have been like the breakout star of the group.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I feel like I get more out of ODB. I get more out of Ghostface. GZA specifically is like that really technical rap side of Wu-Tang.
Yeah, I don't connect to GZA nearly as much as I do Ghostface and ODB. But he was an important part of the Wu-Tang. Moving along, at number 22, we have Life's a Scheme by Buddha Monk. He's a producer who is also affiliated with Wu-Tang. It's kind of got a chilly beat. Otherwise, it wasn't like a super standout track.
Yeah, Buddha Monk was part of the Brooklyn Zoo, Wu-Tang affiliated. There are a lot of contributions on this. It sounds like there are a lot of voices on this song, but I couldn't find a full list of who is on it. It does sample Teddy Pendergrass. I had fun finding a lot of the samples on these charts, which is there's the great resource Who Sampled. You can look up any song and they like queue up the samples and you can play them back to back. They even, there's a lot of stuff that's even just like a phrase is similar to another phrase. like it's a reference, but it's not like an actual like recorded sample, which is pretty fun to find some of those. But yeah, this song didn't leave a big impression on me though.
Nah. Number 33, we have Memphis Bleek Is by Memphis Bleek. He is a Jay-Z protege and one of the first Rockefeller artists. It's a Nas diss track.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, I went crazy about it.
Yeah, I prefer the Nas song that he's referencing.
Yeah.
And Nas in general.
Right. Number 38 is Faban, F-A-Y-B-A-N, I'm not sure how you say it, by Screwball. They were a New York hip-hop group, and their album Y2K The Out. They had an album called Y2K The Album. It's got a funk beat to it, but another one of these ones is just like, it doesn't really hook me. It's lacking a hook, I guess.
It's another nearly unbroadcastable.
Yeah.
Because F-A-Y-B-A-N is an acronym. I'll let you do the research yourself.
Mm. There's a re-entry at number 40, Throw Your Hood Up by Mr. Money Loke featuring Above the Law. He's a Cleveland gangster rapper. It wasn't anything like really notable here. I don't know why it re-entered. It also was on the chart for 62 weeks. What? That can't be right.
Wow.
So does that include the time it was not on the chart?
Yes, I believe that would be, maybe no.
It's the weeks it was on the chart plus the weeks it wasn't?
I don't know that.
Or was it on 62 weeks before? It's a long time for a song that I don't know.
No, I don't know it. It's not especially memorable. Well, number 42, a new entry, Restless by White Dog.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a note that says it's not good.
It uses a Beastie Boys sample, I believe. He's a white rapper from Alabama. This was his biggest hit. I think he's a preacher now. I think that's all I got out of him. Number 44 is another new entry, and it is Get Your Groove On by 5 Cent, featuring Big Al, G-Man, Origin, Psy, and Kenny Mac. And it's a remix of a song from 96, I think. I couldn't figure out why this was on here. I wonder if it just got some, like, radio airplay somewhere and it did well. I don't know. Unsure.
Yeah, it's a remix, and I think the remix was more successful than the original. Okay, G-Funk.
Yeah, which in 96 was already kind of over, so
yeah.
Yeah, so next we have our top R&B albums. At number one, we got Ja Rule, Veni Vedi Vecchi. This is the album that Holla Holla came from. Number two is Rough Rider, Ride or Die, Volume 1. So, okay, this was a label comp that went platinum, which is crazy that a comp went platinum. I was talking about this earlier with the Jay-Z song. They were a collective and a record label. It started as DMX's managers before starting their own label. And this is the third thing they've released ever on Rough Riders, and the first two being DMX records. So this one features DMX, Jadakiss, Eve, Juvenile, Swizz Beatz, Jay-Z, Jermaine Dupri, Mace, Big Pun. And those are like the well-known ones, but they all kind of became names. DMX was already a name at this point. Jay-Z was already a name at this point. But yeah, it's interesting to see a comp. I remember this being around. I remember seeing it in stores. Very iconic, just big letter R on the cover, silver cover. Number three is True, the Crime Family. They were a hip-hop group from Richmond and New Orleans that featured Master P, C-Murder, and Silk the Shocker. Oh. This album features Hootie Who, which samples the Halloween theme.
Right. You know this.
Yeah. Hootie Who! Yeah. It's a pretty big song. And the record features guests by Snoop Dogg. Number four is Slick Rick, The Art of Storytelling. This was Slick Rick's final album. His most famous was The Great Adventures of Slick Rick from 1988. He was one of the golden age of hip-hop rappers, so it's kind of odd that this... It's interesting to see that this did so well, but I guess he was a kind of a beloved figure.
Yeah, I mean, rap has a lot of appreciation for the classics.
Of course, it helps that it had guests. So like Rev Run's on there, Big Boy... Nas, Raekwon, and Snoop Dogg. So it's, you know, it's a golden age of rap.
guy join up with some newer guys, so that's probably why it did well, too. It's interesting that he didn't really do any other albums after that, though. I believe he's even still alive, too. So that's not even the issue. I know he had some jail time. And I think he may live in England now? I'm not sure. And then number five, we have MC8, Section 8. They were new that week as well. He's a Compton rapper who appears in Menace to Society. And he was a member of Compton's Most Wanted. And Ice Cube's on this record. So, some cool stuff there. A few new entries. Sebo's Mob Figas. They were a Bay Area hip-hop group that were formed by Sebo. And they featured guest appearances by Yuck Mouth. Number 74 is Mace, Double Up. You know, Mace is pretty well known on his own. The record features appearances by Puff Daddy, Blackstreet, and Funkmaster Flex. And number 84 is Millennium Hip Hop Party, which is a re-entry on the chart. It's a comp by Rhino Records. It's just one of those, like, infomercial CDs that you saw. And it's just hits from the 80s and 90s.
A Rhino Records release.
Mm-hmm. And then number 100 is the Old School Players, Old School Rappers, which is a cover album of where one review was called it Kids Bop by Adults. So just like these no-name rappers just doing old classic hip-hop songs. Moving on to the hot R&B singles and tracks. There's Airplay, there's Sales, and then there's The Hot. The Hot is a combination of the Sales and Airplay. In the issue, the Sales and Airplay come first. We're going to talk about the singles and tracks first, and then maybe we'll talk about the others. But number one is Fortunate by Maxwell.
Never seen a sunshine like this. Never seen the moon glow like this. Never seen the waterfalls like this. Never seen the lights off like this. Never dug anyone like this. Never had tasty lips to kiss. Never had someone to miss. Never heard a song quite like this.
Fortunate to have you, girl. Glad you're in my world. Just as sure as the sky is blue, I'm blessed the day that I found you.
Ooh, I am not the person to be talking about R&B. I thought the song was pretty boring. But it was nominated for a Grammy for Best Male R&B Vocal Performance, so what do I know?
Yeah. So this song is from the movie Life.
Oh.
A lesser known late 90s Eddie Murphy film, written and produced by R. Kelly. Yeah, it was the best R&B single of the year by Billboard. It was also the best male soul single at Soul Train Music Awards. It was Grammy nominated and Blockbuster nominated. It's been 8 weeks at number one on the R&B charts. So, according to R. Kelly, Maxwell didn't want to sing this song originally. He wanted to sing the song Life, which was given to Casey and JoJo, also for the soundtrack, which Kelly produced. He supposedly rejected Maxwell's bid for the song Life because he felt that the neo-soul singer wouldn't have been believable singing a song from the perspective of a prison inmate. I thought this song was pretty good, more for the production. You have to give him credit. I like the sound of the organs. There's this little sort of filtered sample stepped phase key stab that does a hard pan across the stereo field that was a nice little touch. And Maxwell's voice is good. He's really, really capable singer. Generally, R&B ballads don't do a lot for me. So I was really looking for little things that I enjoyed, but the aspects of it that I like kind of reminded me of like a more laid back Shuggy Otis track or something. It had a little bit of a 70s soul feel.
I remember the Maxwell album in like advertisements for like Best Buy and Media Play. Like it's kind of a iconic cover. It's just like a photo of him, but it's got this like orange filter on it
and his hair is kind of backlit because he has a giant afro, and it's like backlit, and you can see sort of through the ends of it. I remember seeing that a lot in ads for the sales papers for this is $5.99 at Best Buy this week. You know, I don't know really what happened to his career after this, but
yeah, he didn't really take off much after this. He overshadowed certainly by D'Angelo or Erykah Badu in that neo soul style. He had more records though. He didn't go away completely. This is kind of his peak though, I believe.
Move along.
Yep.
At number two, we got Shantae's Got a Man by Shantae Moore. Yeah. I don't remember much about this song. In fact, I have no notes for it. So, did you write anything down for this one?
Not a lot. The talking intro, I do remember this one though. It's got a talking intro and the other talking interludes throughout the song that are just kind of cheesy. It's overproduced. It's not a great song. It's not a memorable hook. It does sample it or reference One Bad Apple by the Osmonds. It like kind of plays almost like as a counterpoint to the main to one of the choruses later in the song, which was an interesting production idea, but otherwise we can move on.
Yeah. Number three is Happily Ever After by Case. It's kind of a standard R&B song. Most notable thing about this is the video features a young Beyonce as his love interest.
Yeah, it spent 20 weeks on the charts.
Yeah, it's been on 15 weeks at this point. It was number 4 the week before, number 7 the week before that. So slowly climbing.
It hung around, but doesn't do much for me.
No. So number 4 is Where My Girl's At by 702, which we talked about earlier. And number 5 is No Pigeons by Sporty Thieves, which also was the greatest gainer in sales that week. And the greatest gainer in airplay. At number 15 is Bills, Bills, Bills by Destiny's Child.
At first we started out real cool, taking me places I ain't never been. But now you're getting comfortable, ain't doing those things you did no more. You're slowly making me pay for things your money should be handling. And now you ask to use my car, drive it all day and don't fill up the tank. And you have the audacity to even come and step to me, ask to hold some money from me until you get your check next week. You're trifling, good for nothing type of brother. Silly me, why haven't I found another? A baller, when times get hard, need someone to help me out. Instead of a scrub like you who don't know what a man's about.
Can't pay my bills, can't pay my telephone bills. Automobiles, you need to make me what you do.
Music,
here's a great one.
Music compresses in my memory. For some reason, I think things, well, not compresses, but it stretches out. I think things happened later than they do based on the music, but I don't know if that's just because it was played for a long time after the fact. But I always thought of Destiny's Child as more of like later, like 2001, 2002. I didn't think of them being right here in the middle of like the boy band explosion and being, I guess they were contemporaries of TLC, I guess, but
yeah, I mean, this is their second album, isn't it?
Is it?
I want to say it was. Let me make sure I'm right about that. Yeah, Writings on the Wall was their second release, which this is the lead single from. This is the breakout album for them. Because it's this song, Say My Name, Jumpin', Jumpin'.
Yeah. I guess I was, what year, 99? I was probably 13, 12, going on 13. That's probably why my memory isn't like perfect.
This was a big hit. I mean, it peaked at number one on the Hot 100. It was also on the R&B hip hop singles in tracks for 9 consecutive weeks, which is one of the longest running number one singles on that chart ever. It's a big song.
It was also
parodied by Sporty Thieves.
Ugh. So this is on its rise then, because it's got a greatest gainer. It hadn't crossed from the R&B charts to the pop charts yet, maybe. Hot 100, I didn't notice if it was on there or not, but it could have been. Maybe one we missed, but... New entries. So the Hot Shot debut at number 75 is All In My Grill by Missy Elliott, featuring Big Boy of Outkast and Nicole Ray. It's another lesser Missy Elliott song, but it's still Missy Elliott, so, you know, it's definitely worth listening to. Big Boy is always fun to have on a track. This was right before the big blow-up for Outkast, right? I guess it depends. Had they become a mainstream success at this point yet? When Stankonia come out?
Yeah, and this is before.
Yeah, it's before Stankonia.
Fresh, clean. Yeah, be any of their really big singles.
They had AT Aliens and Aquemini by this point, but they were an up and comer, so it's cool that, you know, he's being featured on a Missy Elliott song.
Yeah, this is more of that Missy Elliott sound, that heavily syncopated beat, the cello sample. I have a note. This song was released in French markets in Canada and in Europe with, I guess, with the Big Boy verse replaced with MC Solar, which is interesting. I guess this would have been, the sample would have been recognized in French markets, thus the reason for that push.
Yeah.
Because it samples French film composer Francois de Roubaix. Sorry. Ugh. Mouthful of vowels. But I don't have a note about what film it's from. Probably some French New Wave.
At number 8, we have We Can't Be Friends by Deborah Cox, and features guests by the singer RL from the group Next. That's kind of the extent of my notes on that song.
It's mostly led by the guest. I thought that was interesting, because it starts off with him singing. She was a Canadian R&B singer. And it was, I also thought it was interesting that it was played on the radio a lot way before it was released. So they were really trying to push her, but it didn't really catch on, because I'm not familiar with her.
No. Number 80, we have Should I by Jenrique, maybe? Jenrique? It's a jazzy little...
Renique?
No, there's no...
Yeah, it's Grenique.
It is. I typed it wrong. Grenique! Oh, great. She only released one album.
Yeah, she was interesting. Signed to Motown at 22. This is her first, or this is not her first single. This is the first official single from the album Black Butterfly. But her first single was released on the Rush Hour soundtrack before this album came out. So they pushed that out really quickly. But yeah, this is her one album.
Yeah.
She kind of dropped out of music.
At number 85, we have Meeting in My Bedroom by Silk.
There's a party in my pants.
I have no notes for this song either. This is like the worst chart for me to be talking about, mainly because I find a lot of these songs really boring. They're too slow. I'm a very impatient music listener.
Yeah. It's very ballad heavy. I didn't think the song was great. There's a really nice little vocal round, ascending vocal melody of like alternating vocalists on the word bedroom in the chorus. That's pretty nice. But yeah, they're a vocal group, which does even less for me.
Number 88 is Breaker Breaker by GZA. Number 92 is Down 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 by DJ Quick, featuring Mossberg, AMG, and Sugar Free. It's kind of like a smooth rap song. I guess that's why I didn't make it on the rap charts, but it's more on the R&B charts.
Yeah, more G-funk. Kind of sound. This one had some pretty nasty lyrics. There's a line that stood out to me: make it burn every time you pee a gonorrhea. The bass line and the and the phrase "throw your head back, 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 lean it to the side" is lifted from "So Fine" by Howard Johnson, but they re-recorded the bass line. The original has like this really wobbly 80s synthy bass sound that I much prefer. Wow, wow. It's just really funny. more interesting for those production aspects, the sample aspect. Not my favorite song otherwise.
All right, moving on to our next chart. It's more R&B stuff, so it's the hot R&B airplay. So number one is Fortunate by Maxwell. Actually, majority of this top five is the same. Shantae's Got a Man, Where's My Girls At, Happily Ever After. At number five, though, is Anywhere by 112 featuring Lil Zane. This one's kind of neat. It has a little like a funky beat to it, and they're a vocal group, but the Lil Zane verse is nice because, you know, he's a rapper and kind of adds a little bit of edge to the song. The beat and his verse are probably the best part of the song. Otherwise, it's just more like smooth singing.
Yeah, but with the production, that beat being kind of harsh and farty, synthy bass sound, it's an odd decision. It makes it stand out for sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty unique sounding on the R&B charts, and probably why it got a lot of, and the Zane verse probably why it got a lot of airplay.
Yeah, I don't want to go all the way through, like, because all the new entries are just the same new entries that were on the other R&B chart. Though they're on the R&B recurrent airplay, which is the songs that have been on the charts for more than 20 weeks and have fallen below number 50. I don't really know why this exists. I guess it's just to signify that it's an old song, but at the same time, who cares?
Yeah. So this is one of those Billboard chart chicanery.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? What does this mean? Like, the song is just a way to flush out songs that are still immensely popular.
But it's still on the... Is it still on the hot R&B? Because I think that's what it's saying.
Yeah.
It's below number 50. I don't know why we're spending so much time on this. It's a fucking R. Kelly song.
When a Woman's Fed Up. There.
Yeah.
That's the song.
Yeah, I just want to understand what the point of the recurrent chart is. That song's not on the Hot 100. So, nope. No, yeah, he's got another song on there in the Hot 100. So what's the point of this recurrent chart? Is it just to flush out an old song?
Yeah.
And just be like, here, this one still sold a bunch of copies. We're just showing that it did. And yeah,
it's still
on.
Selling a lot of copies and still getting a lot of airplay, but it's been on the charts for so long that we don't want to keep leaving it on the charts because then I guess they look stagnant. That's what it seems like.
This is 20 weeks. So if it's still on the charts for more than 20 weeks and it's below 50, then they don't feel the need to report on it, yet then they feel the need to include it on the smaller chart. I don't know. I mean, I guess that's to keep your chart from looking identical from month to month in the bottom 50, but it's a weird, yeah, here's Billboard being weird. There's the hot R&B single sales. 1 through 5 are all songs we've talked about before. Number one is No Pigeons by Sporty Thieves, but Jennifer Lopez is on this chart, interestingly, If You Have My Love. Fortunate by Maxwell, Shantae's Got a Man, Happily Ever After. New entry was Breaker Breaker. There is one unique song. Well, there's a couple, actually. So at number 48, we have Ring My Bell by Enoj.
Ring my bell.
disco classic song Ring My Bell. This is part of that 90s obsession with like disco and funk I mentioned earlier. It's silly. It's not necessary. Like, I don't know why they were like, we got to make this again. It seems like music for children, almost. It's like that weird ABBA 2 group or whatever, where they just like covered ABBA songs. The video looks like it's full of teenagers.
So this cover, the Anita Ward song, yeah, it really doesn't. It doesn't improve on the song, and it doesn't really change the song all that much either. It's too faithful to the original. But an interesting thing that I found was that she also had a couple of other singles from this record. This is the last in a string of three singles, all of which were covers. The first was Love You Down by Ready for the World, and she also did Time After Time by Cyndi Lauper. No originals from that album were released as singles. And then she didn't release anything again until 2007, when it seems like she did a cover of 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton. So I don't know what the deal was. Were they just, this is a quick buck, do some familiar songs, release them as singles?
I don't know. Just a little quick little capitalization on the interest in funk and disco in the 70s, from the 70s in the 90s. Number 56, we have Play Around by Lil Cease, featuring Lil Kim, Mr. Bristol, and Harve Pierre.
Joe Hooker? I think is what he was known as.
Oh, okay. Lil Cease was part of the Junior Mafia with Lil Kim, and they were formed by Notorious B.I.G., and they broke up after his death. So this was like his attempt at a solo release. At number 61, we have Cold Feet by 40K Crew. We couldn't find this one to listen to.
Nowhere.
So it's weird. I couldn't find it anywhere at all. I don't know what's going on with that. How could something chart and then it not exist on the internet now? Because I feel like it's not that. I mean, it's obscure, but it's not that obscure. I don't know. Number 64 is Perfect Man by Nasty Boy Click. Dylan, do you have some notes on that one?
Yeah, this was an interesting one to me. This, more for who they were. It's a single from Arizona's most successful hip-hop group, which is saying something.
Yeah.
That Arizona doesn't have very notable hip-hop. This song was following their other successful hits, Down For Yours and AZ Side, which is another big single for them, which was notable for being supposedly the first record to receive sampling permission from Madonna. But this song itself is okay. They didn't last very long after this. They ended up changing their name. Some members left.
They changed it to NB Riders?
Yeah. I was interested. I like seeing these obscure songs and artists on Billboard charts.
Mm-hmm. Like super obscure, it feels like. Though there's a Wikipedia article on them, so I don't know. The only other new entries are all ones we previously talked about: Memphis Bleak, Faye Ban, Throw Your Hood Up. Next, we have the Billboard Weather Bureau, an industry forecast for developing artists and the new music climate. I mentioned this one a little earlier, right on the. I guess this was a little insert. I don't know if it was stapled in or if it actually came out of the magazine, but it has its own little table of contents, and it on the front cover says current conditions, and it's rooted in California's emotional hardcore scene. Sensefield delivers its third album in July on page 4. So when you go to page 4, you get to a little article. It's very small. It's called SoCal Sensefield, No Core, Just Rock. And I can't help but think that the marketing. They really fumbled the marketing with Sensefield for a couple reasons. So I mentioned this earlier. This record never came out.
Yeah.
So, okay. As we mentioned earlier, it said it was supposed to be out in July, it was pushed back to October. So in reality, it never actually came out. It kept getting shuffled back due to corporate reorganizing. At one point, it was renamed Under the Radar, and a lot you can find rips of the promotional CD versions that were sent out, and it was planned to be released in 2000. again, never happened. So there's these like promo copies that got like ripped online that you can hear those takes from there. A lot of those songs. So what happened basically was they got signed by a label, by Warner, and then the people that signed them quit working for Warner. And so then the people who took over their account essentially were like, I don't know what to do with this band. What would they do with Sinsfield, honestly? They were up Revelation Records, you know, melodic emo core band. So eventually they were just dropped from the label after they getting shuffled around over and over and over again. And they had to actually sue to earn the rights back to re-record their songs. So weirdly, I guess their contract was one of those real shitty ones where they even owned the songwriting, which really sucks. But they won that. And then
some sort of, signing a publishing deal with your label.
They wound up recording the album Tonight and Forever in 2001. And a lot of songs from that album are from that original session are re-recorded and included on Tonight and Forever. And then there's a couple of songs on an EP that was also included. This happened a lot during this era. I guess it was these labels were like, well, what's popular? Green Day. Well, let's find as many Green Day related bands. And then all of a sudden, that kind of music wasn't popular in the rock scene anymore. New metal was there. So it's really unfortunate because I wish we lived in the world where Sinsfield was as big of a hit as Jimmy Eat World, because that's theoretically the idea.
Right. It's funny to see this prediction of the changes in the music climate accurately predicting emo core, or essentially emo, becoming a big driving force in the music industry, but representing that with a band that did not enjoy any success from that trend. It's a little early.
It is. It's maybe
not that far, because I mean, Jimmy World, Bleed American was 2001, so
yeah,
2 years early.
And Tonight and Forever came out in 2001. But Tonight and Forever, the versions of the songs from the original album that they recorded are a lot heavier sounding and like crunchier, which it fits more with what the previous Sinsfield records sounded like, what Building sounded like in those. But Tonight and Forever is them doing the glossier, like Jimmy Eat World style, and they don't shine under that. It's unfortunate because like there were such good songwriters, but that's not the best way for them to get across. This article also has like an interview with John Bunch, who said, "For me, it was a goal. When we were on Revelation, kids were coming up to us and saying they couldn't find our records." I love that Revelation is being talked about in Billboard. Yeah, they couldn't find our records anywhere. That was kind of frustrating. So obviously, it says Revelation had previously released 2 Sinsfield albums before the band signed with Warner in 96. They signed in 96. The album never came out, and then they released one in 2001.
That sucks.
Yeah.
To be signed up with... I mean, it's the... I know exactly the climate. I mean, it's how Jawbox got on a major label. You know, mm-hmm. It's part of that group of signings that turned out to be not commercially viable. Sam I Am, Jawbox, mm-hmm. all of those records coming out on big labels, and they're doing terribly. And Sinsfield being behind the curve, and then the label just being like, we don't want to do any of this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to release this.
There's even a quote in here from the Warner Brothers VP of Marketing, Peter Raw. He sums up the label's hopes for the band. "It's our belief that they will reach the mainstream. We think Sinsfield could be a band like the Foo Fighters for Warner Brothers."
Wow.
Why would you hear... What record came out? What was the last Sinsfield record to come out before they got signed? Was it Building? Building came out in 96. They didn't get to release another record till 2001 with Tonight and Forever. Warner killed their momentum. I don't know if they were like touring during that time period. I would imagine there was some touring going on. They have some EPs. Like there's a split with Jimmy Eat World and Mineral, the three-way split in 97. The 99 part of the Deal EP.
Yeah, they would have been restricted to only doing those little releases.
Yeah. I don't know what it's like to be signed to a major and not have an album. Like, it was supposed to come out in 99. So that means they took 3 years probably writing that thing. And then it just killed the band, too. Like, they broke up.
They put out an album in 2003 called Living Outside. That was a Heat Seekers. So they could have maybe done something. I don't know. But yeah, it's just fun to see a band that you love that shouldn't be anywhere near the Billboard magazine in there. This little weather bureau thing is weird. So it's like, it's trying to predict these people. And some of them are such big misses. Like this Atlanta's 6X Designs Primary Colored Pop Punk. They were Atlanta pop punk band. They made a record called Kung Pao. One of the members is Chinese, so don't worry about that. and they bond, like the members were like inspired by the Muffs and their Ramones and Ronnie Spector. And what happened? This thing never came out anywhere.
Yeah, there's an article here about Sealed Fate Records trying to recapture the cred of Boston in the heyday of Galaxy 500, the Pixies, and the Lemonheads. But I don't know, is this label or any of these bands on it?
There's a little article about the Local Rabbits called Local Rabbits Rock. I think one of the members of that band just recently died a suicide, which is really shitty because John Bunch also died by suicide. And same little thing. But they kind of nailed a couple things, because if you look at later in this little thing, it says Montgomery Gentry, okay, with Loretta and Leonard. So it's like they predicted Montgomery Gentry doing well, which they did. And there's like a Dido ad in here, yeah, which did well.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's like it's a guess sometimes, but it's funny how badly they can miss. Even in this little Weather Bureau thing, there's an entire article about a musician who was thought to be this big deal, and like she was gonna have like this huge hit. It's this Eye of the Storm article about an artist named Lucy Lee, who had her album picked up for licensing by PolyGram. The record came out in 96. It got picked up for licensing, got shuffled around, and then never got released. It's like, well, you just bought this record's rights, did nothing with it, and she didn't do anything else after that. And it's like, could she have done better if she'd signed a different label, or if somebody else who actually wanted to do something with it signed her up? You know?
Yeah. That's the recording industry. There's, it's full of stories like that, of people getting signed and then nothing happens.
Which, in the 90s, especially.
Yeah. Yeah. They were really, really bad for it then. And it, I guess it was a desperation.
Yeah, because I think in the 90s, the record industry didn't know what to do. Because Nirvana wasn't supposed to happen, and they became one of the biggest bands of all time. And then, you know, grunge became a thing. So then they were scrambling. Then Green Day comes along and throws a wrench in what their idea of what alternative is. So it's just like, let's try everything.
And I mean, even alternative, like as a genre happening. I mean, alternative rock and alternative radio happening in the 80s and into the 90s. And giving airplay and success and creating careers out of artists who were not going through the traditional process of getting signed to a label, getting licensed and pushed and marketed. So there's a lot of just scrambling to follow trends and catch something that's going to be successful. And if they miss that window, then they just shelve your record and drop you.
Well, then they hang on to you forever and never do anything with you.
Oh, yeah, because they don't want, right, because they don't want you, they don't want to release you and you go to another label while you might have a chance of being successful and then actually getting that success and selling well and
because their market like, share. Sinsfield is exactly like a prime example of that, because like they put out one of their best records in 96. It was like only their second full length, I believe, maybe third. And then they don't get to release another full length for almost 5 years. It's like, we could have got two, potentially three more albums, Sinsfield Records, in that time period. Maybe they would have broken up, you know, in that time if they never got signed to anything. But I feel like we were deprived of great records and a band in the prime of their career. It's hard to say. Yeah, that's about it for the Weather Bureau thing, though.
Well, they talk about Lynn.
Steal My Sunshine had come out that year. It was like another, like, what? Surprise hit. It's a surprise hit because what works with that? That band shouldn't. That band didn't work, despite all the Lynn records that were released. But Steal My Sunshine
worked in spite of Len, I guess is what it is. They're like 80s hip-hop, sex kitten vocals, and sarcastic pop. It's like, well, I wouldn't call her sex kitten vocals. Weird. Sarcastic pop. I don't think they were sarcastic.
No.
Hey, everyone. That's the end of part one. Make sure to check out part two in the very same feed you got this episode from. Check us out on social media. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Punklottopod. And thank you.